life without hope. Now that's living hell.
This is what real hope looks like. This is the word that those hopeless people need to hear. This is the word that 3,000 people that try to commit suicide today, the 3,000 that will try to commit tomorrow, 3,000 that will try to commit on Monday, this is the word that they need to hear, is that there is hope.
It's real superpower. It's hope. There's hope. Hope.
Welcome to Victims and Villains. This is the show where we talk nerd, we talk hope, and we speak nothing else. And we are concluding our journey through the Haddonfield Homecoming, all 10 Halloween films that have been released thus far. We will be covering Halloween 2018 in just a couple weeks. But I am your host, Captain Nostalgia. Thank you so much for hitting play. Please help me in welcoming over from the Grindhouse Messiah and our friends over at the Farsighted Network, Mr. Justin Harlan.
I am Justin Harlan. I am one of the co-hosts of Grindhouse Messiah. I run the Farsighted Network / blog / whatever, and yeah, that's me.
And he is our DC official animation correspondent. Please help me in welcoming Mr. Blaine McLaren.
What's going on, man? So I am happy to be back, and I love having an official title. That is how you keep me coming back, is give you official titles that mean nothing outside of the two of us.
No, nothing. But it's like
quite a few titles, but I don't know how official they are.
It's nice to have someone that you can just kind of like have like official people for. So like if you have something that you want to cover, you just be like, hey, I got this. Makes me feel, I guess, a little bit more official having like executive people for executive positions.
No, I appreciate it, and I'm going to do my best to not bring up my excitement for the DC app. So I'm gonna try my absolute best.
We are gonna be talking about that in a future episode, but what we're gonna be doing with that, just making the announcement out, is with now having an official correspondent and the DC Universe app, we're gonna be covering we're going to try our best to cover one animation film a month that is streaming on the app. Blaine and me are still working out details. It'll probably start probably in November, maybe in October. But Justin, if people just give us a little bit of a rehash. So, tell us a little bit about Grindhouse Messiah.
So Grindhouse Messiah is a podcast. We've been around for about almost a year and a half now. Wow, we're getting old. We've been doing stuff, all different types of movies. We call ourselves Grindhouse Messiah because we like a lot of exploitation, horror films, just kind of weird fringe stuff that you would call Grindhouse film. And Messiah was kind of put in there because we're both looking at this from a faith-based perspective. I'm a pastor's kid. Blaine's also a Christian. I wouldn't call us a Christian podcast because, man, there are a lot of Christians who would not want to listen to us. But we very much like to look at both the spiritual and social aspects of film when it's suited.
They put out a great podcast, and we'll have links below. If you guys have never checked out Grindhouse Messiah, please go check these guys out. And even more reason to go check these guys out is part one of this part two part crossover, looking at the Rob Zombie films. Is on Grindhouse Messiah, covering the 2007 film Halloween.
I like that you brought up the year it came out, because I don't think we ever mentioned it.
Oh, I did. I did. I brought it up specifically when I said, I'm not worried about spoiling a movie from 2007.
Oh.
You did.
Very, very clever boy. We were discussing earlier while you were gone about how you being a sensitive boy as well.
Correction, you were.
Me and Josh, we were like, man, that's a sensitive boy.
Well, I could go all different directions with that, but I'm just going to pause and let you finish whatever you're going to say.
All right. I'm going to stop. I'm going to interject. And it's funny because, like, on your show, like, you were talking about how young I was and, like, poking fun at my age, and I feel like the father to two brothers trying to break up a camaraderie and keep focus.
No, very fair. You're doing an excellent job, Dad.
Being focused is really difficult, Dad.
I mean, all right. So we are here talking about Rob Zombie's sequel to Halloween 2, and we're going to get to jump on that in just a little bit. But earlier this year, we had some unfortunate news that we haven't actually had a platform to properly cover until now. So this film actually features one, I can't say one of the final performances because she went on to do 12 more movies after this, but this is actually Margaret Kidder actually stars in this film. And I kind of want to just spend a couple moments just kind of talking about her career and kind of her legacy. She's not in this film for a lot long, but I think for horror fans, she does really resonate with them. Even for Superman fans, obviously she was Lois Lane to a whole generation. So Justin, for you, man, what is your kind of thoughts on the legacy of Margaret Kidder and being able to see her later in her career kind of do a Rob Zombie film?
Margot Kidder's in a lot of stuff and a lot of stuff I dig, but I never felt one way or another about her. As an actress, I just was never connected to her in any specific way. I did like her seeing her come up in a later film. It's always like, oh, I know her. Oh yeah, she's Margot Kidder. You know, and that is kind of, but I am always saddened when I see somebody who's just kind of like a amazing. You know, the fact that I don't have a lot of standout memories of her isn't a testament to me not liking her as much as a testament to the way she blends into her roles. Like, she's one of those actresses that becomes her roles. So, like, I don't necessarily automatically think of her as one specific thing. You know what I mean? But ultimately, it's always sad when we lose somebody who clearly was a good person. There a lot of people just said so many great things about her, and no one had a bad thing to say about her. And so, you know, ultimately, I think she did a good job in this movie. I really liked her.
I really agree with that statement. Like, for me, like, she's not in, like, there's not a lot of performance of hers that really kind of stands out. I grew up on her in Amityville Horror and Superman, and like watching this film for this most recent time, like, it didn't click with me that the therapist in this is actually Margot Kidder, because even though, like, you know, she plays such a small role in this, like, she does embody every role that she does. Like, when you watch her as Lois Lane, like, you truly do believe that she is Lois Lane. Like, and even in Amityville, like, she does such a wide range as, like, mom and also, like, you know, fearful and you know. So it's kind of cool to get to have a platform to now speak on her. It kind of sucks that we waited 6 months after she died. So, but Blaine, man, what about you?
I mean, Margot Kidder for me is always going to be Lois Lane, no matter what form. You know that when you say the words Lois Lane, the first thing that pops into my head above anything else is Margot Kidder. Her in those oversized shirts. I don't know, man. I had such a crush on her when I was a kid. And then also, like, mentioning, like, I almost forgot that she was Kathy Lutz. I even kind of strolled through the IMDb. And I'm thinking, gosh, I forget how much great stuff she kind of came in and out of it. Even later in her career doing the, you know, little cameo spots. Still such great chops. I know she struggled with a lot of personal issues over the years and had a rough time with Hollywood. But I mean, it's one of those things that it's terrible that it had to wait till she passed for everyone to come out and tell these great stories and these experiences with her. But yeah, no, I mean, she's one of those just classic actresses in my mind. You know, just like you said, in Amityville, she plays the mom, a very, very foxy mom at that. But very great. She's really, to me, she's the best part of that movie because everyone else is pretty wooden in that movie. But she, I think she really kind of carries that whole film on her shoulder. So, yeah, rest in peace. And, I'm so glad we got to talk about her because I have to admit, I always forget that she's in this movie. There's a lot of people in this movie that I forget are in it until they pop up on screen. And then I get to just kind of go, oh, shoot, that's them, you know, so.
Hey, yeah. If people listen to the previous episode, our first part over on Grindhouse Messiah, they heard me say that I believe the John Carpenter Halloween film never broke a lot of ground. You know why? Because a lot of the ground it supposedly broke was broken by a little film called Black Sunday.
You mean Black Christmas?
Oh, they're all the same shit. No, Black Christmas. They're not the same at all.
You're about to say Black Sunday? The Mario Bava anthology? Yeah.
Well, you didn't know she's in Mario Bava's films? No. In Black Christmas, which is a Bob Clark, who, you know, was... What? You want to say something to me?
No.
Okay. Yo, I don't know how I'm going to deal with this video thing, man. This is crazy. I have to be clothed and stuff. No, but anyway, point of the story, Margot Kidder is awesome. So go back to what you're saying, Josh. Man, Reynolds is tough, man.
I was going to say, like, I have not actually ever seen Black Christmas. I know it exists. But to me, like, I've had, like, thousands and not thousands, but like a lot of people tell me that it's a film that I need to see, because like as big as into slashers as I am, like that is, like you were talking about, it is the film that kind of broke open that whole genre of horror.
Right, it's like the proto slasher. It's not quite a slasher, but it kind of like really set the ground for the slasher.
Yeah.
It's not a film that I particularly love. It's a film that I really respect, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I find it a little dull at times, a lot dull at times, and actually find the remake more fun. But I think that some of the stuff it does is really interesting.
Yeah, see, and I want to pitch something. Maybe this year around Christmas, we hit Black Christmas in the Black Christmas remake. Maybe think about it.
I'm down.
All right. Yeah, it's in the books. All said and done. Love Margot Kidder. So glad that we get to celebrate her tonight.
Yeah. So, what is your guys' favorite memory of Margot Kidder? What is your favorite role that she ever did? Make sure that you guys tweet to us @VictimsAndVillains, and write to us on Facebook @VictimsAndVillains as well. Or you guys can comment wherever you guys are currently listening to this podcast. And but with that, we are going to take a quick commercial break, and we're going to just jump into this masterpiece. No, it's not a masterpiece. We're going to talk all things Rob Zombie's Halloween suit when we get back.
Are there real ghosts in Ms. Pac-Man? Are satanic secrets hidden in your Excel spreadsheet? Did Pokemon cause a spike in suicides in Japan? Hello, gamers. I'm Tim Gibson, host of the Cabinet Podcast. I look at the strange occurrences behind your favorite video games. A new weird, creepy story drops every 2 weeks on Wednesdays. That's the Cabinet Podcast, available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, and other major podcast platforms.
Michael Myers.
I know he's not going to come back just because of some stupid holiday.
Are you a giant?
On August 28th...
Call 911. There's blood everywhere.
Rob Zombie completes his extreme vision.
Happy Halloween. How do you like two bullets?
Of a terrifying legend.
What do you want from me?
Stop! Halloween 2. This film's not yet rated.
All right, welcome back. And, like always, after the commercial break, we are putting in the spoiler warning, because I'm gonna throw that up there just in case no one has ever heard this. Justin just dove right into it over on Grindhouse. That's not how we do things over here on Victims and Villains. So I'm gonna turn this over to Blaine. What are your general thoughts on this film, man?
Oh, I think this movie is a masterpiece. I want to argue what you said right before the break. This is one of my favorite films from Rob Zombie, who we talk about ad nauseum in the other episode about, you know, what we like and what we don't like about him. I think this is the first time we really start seeing him, I don't know, kind of find his footing and kind of go beyond that just white trash aesthetic that he's kind of playing through over and over again. I think that this is a much cleaner film in the way it's filmed. I believe in this one, he does work with Brandon Tross as a cinematographer and gets a better kind of idea overall what he wants the movie to be. And I love it because as much as this is a sequel to Halloween, it feels like a completely different film. I feel like he decided to go completely left field. It's essentially an art film dressed up in Halloween Michael Myers clothes. So I think I really do think this is a film that may even be hard to watch the first couple of times, but I think it grows on you and you can kind of build appreciation. I think it's one of those movies that you may not love it the first time you watch it, but the more and more you watch it, the more detail and the more kind of craftsmanship you see going on in the movie, where part one is kind of, you know, it's very different, but it's still more of a Halloween film. This is just something completely different. And I love it for it. I mean, Michael Myers is just like some weird hippie dude walking around chasing white horses. Most of the movie is just like a weird music video kind of aesthetic. Kind of reminds me a lot of, like peak late 90s music video kind of filmmaking. And I don't know, he just makes a lot of big decisions that could work for some people and maybe go the opposite direction for others. But yeah, this is a movie that I revisit probably twice a year. I mean, it's so weird. I can't wrap my brain around it. And it has me coming back over and over again. Every time it kind of pops in my brain, don't get me wrong, it's far from perfect, but I do think there's something special about the film.
And Mr. Harlan.
All right. So, I don't know that I go masterpiece, as Blade used the phrase, but, I would say, all right. So hands down, I'm not going to say it's the best. I'm going to say it's the most interesting film in the entire Halloween franchise. It's interesting in how it does so much, and such an interesting mythology is drawn out through it. Specifically, also, one of the things that really strikes me is that it is the bridge from Trailer Park Rob Zombie to... And you admitted you have not seen Lords of Salem, but to Lords of Salem, weird avant-garde art film Rob Zombie. This is the bridge. This film is strict, like, not only just in time, but it bridges those two aesthetics. It's got the weird surreality stuff going on that is what Lords of Salem is, but it still has that bridge to the early Rob Zombie material. I really like how it does that. But as far as a Halloween film, I just think it's so cool that he's being guided by this, like, otherworldly, from the other side, you know, mom and young him telling him what to do and trying to reunite his family. It's so bizarre. So bizarre. It's actually even hard to call it a true slasher. Because it's also like this weird, like, phantasmic thing going on. But it's just really interesting. Like, the only word that always keeps coming to my head is it's interesting. Like, it's so different what he's trying to do.
No, I completely agree. And I want to really echo that. I feel like this is a completely different Halloween movie than anything that exists in this franchise minus Season of the Witch. But I feel like this is a film that, like I said on your show, like I am on the fence between the three of us. I really, really love Carpenter's Halloween. I think that Rob Zombie's first crack at Halloween is a decent one, but it's not perfect. I feel like this surpasses the first film in so many ways, because it shows it focuses on Laurie, and I feel like that's where the original sequel completely goes out of the windows, is because if you look at the 81 version, it focuses on all these different characters, whereas this one really focuses on the central characters. This film, you talked about it being interesting. I think that this is one of the most intimate films that we've ever gotten in the Halloween film. is because it doesn't focus on these, like, all these teenagers having sex and all these, you know, all their characters and all the characters of those characters. This film essentially focuses on Laurie, Annie, and Sheriff Brackett. Like, those are the three arcs that you have mainly throughout the story that are interwoven along with Michael's. And then my biggest complaint about this film, though, is Loomis. If you took Loomis out, it would be the same exact film. He serves no purpose at all to this film.
See, I, and I'm sure everyone's already listened to the Grindhouse Messiah episode and heard how much I love Loomis in that movie. I love him just as much in this one, but I can't argue that it's much of a difference, but I do think you get just some fun performances. Like when he goes on the Chris Hardwick show with him and Weird Al.
That is amazing. Chris Hardwick and Weird Al. Like, well, yeah, first of all, the fact that Weird Al is just kind of there, and like, that's just amazing. But Chris Hardwick rips the shit out of him, and it's awesome. And I'm not even necessarily a Hardwick guy or anything like that, but like in that particular thing, I was like, oh man, he just slew him. Like, that was crazy.
Right. So I mean, I love those little just fun performances, and I think that there are just a lot of these scenes in this movie that you could completely remove it and it wouldn't alter the film itself. But I like those flourishes. I love the scenes with Daniel Roebuck and wasn't Jeff Daniel Phillips in the strip club. Like all those scenes, I mean, they're not important and they really don't drive any story, but I just love those fun performances.
You just like more excuses for boobs.
I do enjoy nudity very much, and I do enjoy seeing the female form less clothed than usual, but I also love just seeing these kind of these weirdo characters interacting. And it's funny that the first film is very Midwestern, where we were talking about before, being an Atlanta resident. This film is very Atlanta. It's very Georgia. A complete disclaimer, I've probably 5 or 6 friends that worked on this film in one iteration or another, but I love it. It takes place all over, you know, where I grew up, you know, down to even the strip clubs. So it's really funny to see, like, to see, because I watch it and they have bands that from Atlanta. You know, a lot of this stuff is like, man, this is so, when I was watching it today, it kind of dawned on me. I was like, man, this is a really, like, Atlanta-centric film. Like, you see people in the crowd, and you're like, oh, that's so-and-so. And I don't know, it's just, I love it. Even when they're chasing around the Marietta Square, also featured in Dumber and Dumberer, for all you out there looking for some fun trivia.
Can I ask you a quick aside real quick, and I don't want to derail us too much, but I am a huge Dumb and Dumber fan, and I refuse to see Dumber and Dumberer or whatever. Should I give it a try?
No.
Okay, oh, thanks. Really? Right. I like, it doesn't add anything to the mythology, but it's a funny movie. Come on.
I mean, like,
all right, so basically what I'm getting here is, next time I'm in the mood for something really just dumb fun, give it a try.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, right. I would agree with that. It also held up traffic for a really long time for me, like 3 weeks of filming. I was having to do huge detours. But yeah, no, but and I know, kind of getting back to what we were saying with Loomis, I agree that he's unnecessary in this movie, but I still love it. I still think he puts on a fun show. And part of this movie is, I think, Rob Zombie kind of putting all of his buddies, all these character actors, people like Richard Brake. I mean, all just kind of saying, hey, why don't you kind of ham it up for 5 or 6 minutes and we'll make a scene around it. And I do feel like this movie, and this is complete speculation, but it doesn't feel like it's as scripted as the first movie. It feels like he lets a lot of these people just kind of go off the cuff, especially Brad Dourif, who just, man, he turns it up to, you know, up to 11 in every single moment. And
could you make the same argument you made about how Loomis was the star of the first one, like that Brad Dourif as the sheriff is kind of the star of this one?
I love that. Like, to
I
me,
love
like
Brad Dourif in this film.
Like I feel like he really got to show his acting chops, because if I remember correctly from like research, like he's a classically trained actor, correct?
Very much so, yeah. And I mean, this is, in my opinion, this is his best role since Deadwood. Yeah, Brad Dourif is like, he's one of those kind of like Royal Shakespearean kind of guys. Malcolm McDowell, you got a lot of like real, you know, seasoned actors in this movie.
The weird irony of Brad Dourif being this classically trained guy who made all his money by being the voice of Chucky.
Right.
Yeah. And like, I feel like there's, I talked about a one moment, like a dramatic defining moment. And Brad Dourif is the guy that has it. It's at the end where Annie's been killed by Michael, and it's just his reaction, but it's spliced in with some beautiful orchestration and home video of just her as a child. Like, to me, like, as I was watching that, I was like, I've never noticed that before, but that's a really well crafted moment. It's just like everything stops because you feel that weight of that of what he's feeling, because there's a psycho on the loose, but his daughter just got killed. And as a father, you have to imagine that everything, every just moment, everything around him just pauses for that. And you get to experience that with him. And that's just a really well crafted scene, I feel like, that Zombie just doesn't get a lot of credit for.
No, no, I agree. And also the scene with when he shows up with the pizza, I think that's a really great scene to see, like, kind of how good-hearted Dourif is. Because in the first movie, he's just kind of there to tell the story of how Laurie Strode became Laurie Strode. In this movie, he is kind of the emotional core, and kind of, you know, these two young girls are relying on him to, you know, support them and everything like that. And it's, I don't know, Brad Dourif is a slept-on actor who I just don't think he gets the roles he deserves. But yeah, no, he kills it.
Have you ever seen the movie The Control Group that came out last year?
No.
Don't. but it's another example of Brad Dourif acting his ass off in a movie. Well, actually, I like this movie, clearly, but he's awesome in a horrible movie. He does not get the right roles. That is totally fair. You brought up Annie, Josh. Annie, can I just say that Danielle Harris is my favorite scream queen in like the modern era, period. I think she is gorgeous. I think she is awesome. And I just want to point out that I like Danielle Harris a lot.
No, we talked about it and when we did Halloween 4 and 5, like, those are very underappreciated films in the franchise. But to me, like, I feel like even when it's not the strongest, like, she still is very strong. And
she's also the only actor that's in both the previous series and the Rob Zombie series,
which I truly love. Like, I love that he kind of paints that homage. And you know, we talked about this being kind of new territory for the Halloween sequel, for the Halloween franchise. And what it does is, so after you kind of have this introduction into the aftermath of kind of what happens at the hospital with Annie and Laurie, you fast forward to 1 year later and you kind of see how Laurie's kind of coped with this. And she's like, I guess, like, would you say that she's now like a Satanist or like a rebellious person?
I don't know exactly what she is. She's kind of weirdly like, I don't know. All I know is she's like hangs out with a group of gals who like to be promiscuous and goof around and whatever. And she's definitely a little rebellious. Yeah.
She's quote unquote dark, I think is how I'd put it. She's a little edgelord, but also, like, let's not forget Bria Grant in this movie, who's also just acting it up and really slaying it on that side as well. But yeah, that other girl that goes as Frankenfurter, she is unbelievably irritating. Every time she's on screen, I just want to stick my fingers so deep in my ears that blood goes everywhere. But yeah, I mean,
you got to have an annoying best friend. Like,
oh God. Yeah. But she's so annoying. And other things that annoy me, that scene when they go in and she's drinking beers after she can't get her medicine. And Lori goes, "This is my new best friend," or something like that. Something like those. Like, do you guys know what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah. Which yeah, I watched that scene last night.
Yeah. There is, like, I was searching a lot. I was hoping to find, like, a good gif of that, and there's not, which I'm very sad, and hope someone out there listening, please make that and send that to me so I can just send that to Justin and Josh every time I'm bored. But yeah, like, there's still, like, some really, really cringy stuff in this movie where you do get, like, oh my gosh, did you guys... I mean, this was shot digitally. You could have done more than one take of that scene. It's just the worst fake drunk acting.
Is the Frankenfurter, I'm trying to remember, the one who plays Frankenfurter, that's Angela Trimbor, isn't it?
It is, yeah, yeah. She's,
and I actually really like her, but God, do I want to punch her in the face in this movie.
No, I think that there's, I think I just lost my train of thought.
It happens, brother.
It does. So anyways, I'm going to dive into... No, I remember what I was going to say now. you look at... I think one thing that I appreciate more about this film is the theatrical cut. We were talking about this the other day. Like, I think I'm the only one of the three of us that had the privilege of seeing this one in theaters.
No, I got a chance to see it in theaters as well, and... I'm the other way around, man. I really like this director's cut because I didn't like this movie the first time I saw it in theaters. I kind of hated it.
Can I ask the two of you a question then? As the, only having seen the unrated cut, what are the big differences?
The Lori's arc in this is more tame. It's more defined, and kind of being more in the forefront of trying to bring conversations about mental health. I appreciate the unrated cut more. So, like, the more that I watch it, the more that I appreciate it. But to me, like, she's a little less whiny and she's a little less aggressive in the
So do they spend less time cut, in the actual diving into her mental health and stuff then?
Just a little bit, like it's not like a massive difference, like, okay, say a Batman versus Superman justice, like, director's cut. But I mean, it's just like, it's like little scenes like here and there. I think it's like 15 minutes shorter.
I mean, that's a pretty good amount because some director's cuts are 3 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, you know,
Blade Runner.
3 minutes is a pretty decent. Yeah, right. Yeah. But well, no, and you know, actually, funny you brought up Batman vs Superman. I'd never seen the PG-13 cut. I've only seen the R-rated director's cut, and I really liked it. And everybody's like, "Oh, you should see the other one. And why it's horrible?" I was like, "You know what? If that's why it's horrible, why would I bother watching the other cut?"
Exactly.
So, yeah. But anyway.
And also, there's some the Loomis stuff is really different, if I remember correctly, in the original cut. Am I remembering that right, Josh? You seem to have a better memory on that original.
Yeah, so like the Loomis stuff too. Like, he's still a D-bag, but
right.
it's not as again. It's like a lot of like the director's cuts go to the extreme. And I feel like that's kind of why I don't like it, because I already didn't like the Loomis, but kind of watching it again, like I don't watch it as much as you have watched it, Blaine, but I do appreciate this film. It's one of my higher films up on the list of Halloween films. But I think one thing that I really respect most about this film is single-handedly is the look inside of the, like, how this affects a person. It kind of gives it that grounded feeling, because if you were kind of going through that, like if you went through this, like you kind of, we talked about this with H2O, like you would go one of two ways. You would either learn to defend yourself in case they came back, and you would be this gun-toting awesome chick, or you would be driven to addiction or alcohol. And we've already seen one of those in H2O. We're getting ready to see the alternative in the new Halloween. So for like this version of Laurie Strode, I really enjoy the mental health aspect because I feel like it's handled very realistically, where you have this traumatic experience and you just constantly have PTSD about it, especially being so fresh in your mind of only a year.
Oh yeah, and big difference between the original and the director's cut. Original, it's only 1 year between it. The director's cut, it's actually two. Oh. Yeah, so I just remembered that, and that's all IMDb from earlier today.
Also, correct me if I'm wrong. In the director's cut, which is the only one I've seen, she has like the very beginning of the film. It actually something happens a little bit after the initial thing, and then again, there's another lapse of time.
I believe so. And then also you get those which I think plays into what Josh is talking about, is those kind of daydreams and those nightmares with it, which I love Octavia Spencer in this movie. She's one of those people that I always love seeing pop up, especially in these, when she does kind of lesser work than she, to be honest, deserves. She's so good, and I think that really plays to that side of PTSD, where it's like, no, going through this kind of experience, unless you're Jamie Lee Curtis, you're going to be pretty broken mentally. And I think that adds up, because I'm sure we'll get to the ending. I don't think you can justify that bold swing for the fences ending unless you have all that buildup. If not, I feel like it's a cheap ending. But with all those nightmare scenes and hallucinations and buildup of her in this director's cut, where she is in this kind of manic, terrified state, I think it pays off in the end really well.
Right, and I think there's so many interesting character arcs in this film. Like you're saying, the payoff is great, and they definitely deliver like the build up to it with her. I for some reason in my head, I keep coming back to Loomis, because you brought up Loomis in the first film and how you love him in the first film, and then Josh is talking about how much he hates him in this film. But here's the thing, I think that's exactly what Rob Zombie wants. Look at how greed has corrupted this guy who actually gave a crap about this kid's life, and now he sees dollar signs in his eyes, you know what I mean? And it just changes him. You know, he just becomes this jerk, this prick, you know? Like, he's just all about, how can I sell my book and make more money? And you know what? I've met way too many people who seem like good people, and when those dollar signs come up, they're different person.
No, I totally agree with that, and like that's kind of where I think you talked about it, where you'd made the comment where you don't necessarily like the comment you made about Black Christmas, not necessarily liking it but respecting it. And there's the choice and the handling with Loomis in this film is one that I while I don't like, it's something that I do appreciate, because it adds another layer of depth to the realism that this film centers around. And I was talking with some people on Facebook today, and they were kind of talking about how this experience, like, it would turn him into this like pseudo celebrity. Like, this is something that would really happen, and you talk about how this really would happen, and like, a lot of things that happen throughout this arc, I feel like are stuff that, it would really happen. And I think one thing that this film does really well too, with you kind of diving back into Laurie's arc, is that, you can kind of see that there's this brokenness, but once the book comes out and she reads it, there's this kind of break within her. Almost kind of similar to, if you've ever read The Killing Joke, when Jack Napier sees himself after the chemical burn as the Joker for the first time. There's just something within him that breaks mentally. And I feel like this is definitely something that just kind of breaks with her, and it builds so beautifully to the ending with her and Loomis and Michael in the shack.
No, I think that's a really good breakdown of that, because you need to have it.
I love that you still brought it back to the DC universe, but anyway. I mean, to be completely fair, dude, Killing Joke is one of the best comic books ever written in the history of the craft. But I think you really hit the nail on the head on exactly what I was trying to say there, dude. You don't have to like a character to respect what the director's doing. You know what I mean? And with that character. Yeah. I mean, you kind of hate that he destroys Loomis for you in a weird way. You know, like, oh, man, Loomis was so cool in the first movie, and now I freaking hate him. But he does it in such an interesting way.
Oh, yeah. And have you guys ever gone through the IMDb viewer reviews for this?
No.
But I'd love to hear a few. Do you have them up?
I've got a few of them up, and a lot of it are phrases like inhumane, cruel garbage. I mean, these are the kind of total crap. Made Halloween Resurrection look like a masterpiece.
Wow.
One just says, "Dear Lord, ... How, and like, I mean, total waste of time and money. This movie was a disgrace, a painful movie going experience, still a struggle to get through. Are we done letting Rob Zombie ruin movies? Seriously?" It's so funny how, like, we talk about, like, even in that, with that kind of cruelty with that character, this is something that is not well regarded among Halloween fans. I mean, I know some people with a little more of an open mind, but overall, this is such a hated film. And I think a lot of that has to do with kind of how Loomis is treated and all those characters. But I mean, that's also what makes it kind of special.
Can I draw a parallel to Alien, the Alien franchise, and Prometheus, in the way that Prometheus explores a completely different side of the mythology, and people freaking rejected the crap out of that film? I will contest that it's like one of the best Alien films. Like, I love that movie, but I completely get why Alien fans have rejected it, because it goes in such a different direction that it almost just kind of gives a middle finger to the fans. You know what I mean? And I feel like this is that movie for the Halloween franchise.
But I feel like, too, like, this is almost kind of like a missed opportunity, because I would have loved the way that this film ends. So, like, this film ends with a beautiful shot of Laurie getting the knife chopped, like, shot out of her hand. And it's just like this picture by picture kind of downpour. And it's so beautifully done. But when you finally kind of come over it, you reintroduce it as, like, Whitehall. You're seeing her, and she is going through this, like, she's just in this white hall, and she's dressed in white, and she just kind of smiles at the camera. That's where it ends. And, like, to me, I love that aspect, because I would have loved to see what would happen next, because in the comics for Halloween, they've actually explored Laurie taking up the mantle of Michael, and that's always a concept that I've wanted to see in the big screen, and Rob Zombie set it up for that way, and it looks like for a while that's the direction that they were going to take, even when they brought in a new director and a pair of screenwriters. And then it just kind of sat in limbo for a while until Blumhouse got their rights. And so for me, like, I kind of would have liked to see this kind of almost like self-contained trilogy of these films. Because while I feel like the story is both complete, it also leaves the door open. So it also kind of gives you a sense of it's not complete.
Oh, yeah. And the way that final shot, have you noticed the face similar, as I know you all listened to part one? We talked a little bit about Hitchcock at the end of the film, where you see that kind of overlay. With where you see some of the Michael Myers face in the Laurie Strode, just like in Psycho. I love it, because it's because in my brain, even though that film never was made, in my mind, it just plays so well to see her go on and just follow this. It probably
in your mind is amazing, isn't it?
It really is. In my brain, I know. I mean, I can almost say with a certain level of certainty here that I wouldn't have liked that as an actual movie, because then we would have had to listen to her like scream and be like, I'm Michael Myers' sister, you know, F you and all that.
Which she already said 25 times in this movie.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Just painful to sit through all those parts. I love that direction, because that's where the moment where you realize that there is a chance that Rob Zombie might be trolling fans. I mean, am I wrong? I mean, it's because I have a theory.
If there's a director who would do it, he's the one.
And I do have a theory about this movie that he tried his best to make a different take on Halloween. A lot of the fanboys were loud and really trashed his attempts of making something that was a homage, but still his own with the first one. And I don't think he wanted to make a Halloween movie at all. They just gave him money.
He actually did not want to make a Halloween 2. And yeah. He's like, the story I wanted to tell, I told it. And like, I would have been okay. But to me, I feel like there are so many elements of this that just, aside from the beginning with him digging, like, banging his way essentially out of the coroner's van, like, this film is really, really grounded in a way that the first film essentially was. And like, I love so much of the grounded nature with this film. And again, like, I love the fact that, you know, you're seeing that one of the best scenes, I think, in this scenes is when it's a scene between Laurie and Annie, and I think it's the same exact scene you were talking about where, you know, with the beer, Blaine, where, you know, and she just kind of looks at, she's like, you know, look, you're not the only one that whose life got messed up that night. Like, you know, stop having this like pity party. And I feel like it's something that is so self-contained within this film that I would have loved to see it, but Rob Zombie grounds these characters in such a way that, you know, like we were talking about today, like, you know, this is not a lot of people have survived a horror film. So if you haven't survived a horror film, how would you know what it you know takes to truly survive? Like, this is what, these are the events that I think would unfold if victims truly went through a night similar to Halloween or a Friday the 13th. This is what this is the psychology of these survivors.
Oh yeah. And it's kind of the anti-Scream, where like you see Neve Campbell's character, she kind of goes on to be like relatively well adjusted to every bizarre plot point that gets thrown at her of her family and all these murders. This film shows, you know, people being completely broken. I mean, because as bad as things are for Lori, Daniel Harris, I mean, she gets shredded up in that first movie. We spend, about 5 minutes of the opening just looking at all the wounds she suffered in her confrontation with Michael Myers. And I mean, I think, and once again, I know I feel like I'm just like, picking on Scout Taylor Compton, but Daniel Harris acts circles around her, and that's what's so missed, I think, at a certain point with having her as Laurie, is everyone is so good around her, like, to where we're talking about, we can agree on one of the best performances being Daniel Harris in that scene, while it is embarrassing to watch just the line before that. I think that's important not to overlook, because these are actual reactions to a horror movie rather than, like, I've always wondered, like, I want to see the legal nightmare of surviving a horror movie. and being the last person left. I want to see, that's what I want to see. I want to see a courtroom drama after a Halloween movie.
Well, then you have to prove that you weren't involved in the killing. You have to prove that you know, like all that. Yeah, right.
I want to see someone like with their head in their hands complaining about a $20,000 bill to lawyers. I want to hear, which I know I might be the only person, but I've always been curious, like, what's the litigious side of surviving a horror film? Where this film, okay, all that aside, this film nails the emotional side.
Yeah, I think this film is as close as you're going to kind of get to that aesthetic of, you know, what happens the night afterwards, because, you know, having watched a good deal of these like documentaries or a docuseries where you kind of see victims of, you know, sexual assault or kidnapping, they kind of go through these like those moments change them, and you get to see the changes firsthand, and you know, I love that. Like, I don't know. Like, and do you guys ever think that maybe like the night of Halloween and the original one has something to do with why Danielle Harris's character and Scout Taylor Compton's character in this film are vegetarians?
Oh, I kind of forgot about that. Yeah, that's a good call. Yeah, I kind of oversee that just because I'm like, oh man, Brad Dourif is so great. Yay. And I just started thinking that they were just being annoying.
But he did forget to get the whole wheat crust.
Hey, I'm trying my best. I'm Brad Dourif.
I'm going to be honest with you. Whole wheat crust is booty, man. That is not pizza.
You have a lot of strong pizza-related opinions.
I was born in North Jersey, dude. Pizza is like life.
Oh man, that's the last thing your doctor wants to hear.
Oh man. Well, anyway, yeah, no, I'm with you, man. I Danielle Harris, the part of the reason I said she's one of my favorite, you know, modern scream queens is that I think she's a fantastic actress. Like, not just is she gorgeous, because she is gorgeous, you know, don't get me wrong, but she's also just really good. Like, she sells everything she's in. There was a movie I watched earlier this year called Inoperable. Wasn't a good movie. But she's freaking awesome in it. Like, there's something about, like, she can elevate a movie that's not that great into be something that I actually really enjoy. And I mean, this movie I actually really enjoy, probably even without her, and she takes it up a notch. Her and Brad Dourif are a large part of what makes this movie for me.
Yeah, and she's super short.
This is true. My wife is super short, so I guess I like short ladies.
Oh, well, that's...
I'm also very tall and large. It's just kind of weird. But, you know.
Yeah, it was like side note on short people. I've had this huge crush on Jordan Ladd for years. Met her in person. She was so tiny. It was just off-putting. But that's...
Wow, completely random.
Sorry, guys.
So, in other words, one thing that people are going to take away from this episode of Victims and Villains is that Blaine McLaren is a heightist.
Well, I guess we can't be friends anymore.
I'm a height beast. That was really bad. Yeah, and
that was a dad joke and a half, bro.
Oh, rough. Yeah, sorry,
all right,
guys.
All right. I'm gonna reel us back in. We're going back in
Halloween 2.
Moving on to Roads to Hope. This is the point in our show where we engage with our guests of the week with a topic revolving around mental health that is spinning out of our episode source material. And this film is so heavy with the benefits of therapy and medication and just really getting help and resources and the importance of communicating. And just there's so many mental health themes that are just woven throughout this. I feel like we could literally spend a whole nother episode just kind of talking about the mental health side of this. We've spent a lot of time talking about the horror side of this. Just why do you think that it's so important to have these conversations after traumatic events? Let's start with Blaine.
Yeah, I mean, being on your show before and kind of talking about my background with mental health as being someone who regularly goes to therapy and also, you know, takes medication for mental health issues. I think they portray it in a pretty for a horror film. They portray it in a pretty real way. Those scenes with Margot Kidder are incredibly compelling. And I do think even on a very micro level of what most people would go through in therapy, there are those moments where you just, you are frustrated and that, you know, it's not that they don't care. I do believe most people that go into being therapists and psychiatrists and psychologists, I think they legitimately do care. I'm sure there's some out there that just do it for the paycheck, but she's going on about, you know, for $100 an hour and blah, 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 just being kind of just a, you know, just being a self-involved person at that moment. I mean, that's part of what therapy is sometimes being that self-involved person that, you know, that you can't be in public because it's part of why you pay $100 an hour. And I'm not saying that her behavior is excused or anything like that, but I can sympathize with it. I think I've been in therapy for, I think, around 6 years now. And I mean, there's been times where I've just been like, you don't care. You just want the money. It's like, of course you like look back at, you know, you take a shower the next day and you're like, oh gosh, it's so embarrassing. But I find it very, sympathetic. I think it's one of the more like honest, you know, sort of, assessments of how mental health does go in real life. I mean, cause you're not laying on a couch going, I was, you know, when I was four, I remember looking up my mother's leg or whatever, you know, it's not like that. Like, you know, like you're watching Analyze This or something. It's much more of that kind of fluid. And like, sometimes you go into therapy and you are pissed off or you're mad or you're sad, whatever it is. And I mean, of course, in a scenario like myself and probably like most people that go to therapy, you're not going, oh my gosh, I found out that I'm the sister of a murderer and all my friends and family are dead. But I do think that it takes place. And I wouldn't be surprised if Rob Zombie regularly attends therapy, because it's got a real vibe. It's kind of, you sit there, you stand up, you walk around, you talk to somebody. It kind of hits all the mundane real parts of, you know, kind of that daily self-care of mental health. So no, I think the movie really nails it. I mean, outside of even just the wild horror stuff, I think they do a good job of nailing what it's like to actually be someone who says, you know, I take my medication, I go to therapy. That doesn't always just zap up and fix the problem. You know, there's still, you know, things that you deal with day to day that those things aren't going to help. But I, you know, the way she reacts and, you know, turns to alcohol and things like that, I think is what a lot of people end up doing, because they go to therapy and things aren't fixed overnight. And they think just because you spend, you know, $1,500 that your problems should be gone. That's not how it goes. So no, I really appreciate the way they handle it.
Yeah, I really do too. And I think that, you know, from someone that watched, I've never, you know, gone to therapy, but I've always kind of had outlets to use as therapeutic. And my dad went through a really traumatic experience as a kid and bottled it up for years and years and years, and finally went to therapy for it. And when he had to open up about it, I mean, he contemplated suicide as a means to not go through that experience again. I feel like that this film is really honest in its portrayal, because it's not going to be this overnight thing that is going to cure you. It's going to be a experience, like she says in this. There's a specific line where they're in the therapy and she says, you know, you need to fix your we need to fix your brain, or we need to fix the way that you think, or the something along those lines. And I think that that's part of the way that we need to turn, and we need to look at this, is by really engaging and saying, you know, look, therapy is a step. It's not the, it's not the, it's not a band-aid. It's kind of like the first aid that is starting the process of the healing.
No, that's no, that makes sense. I mean, yeah, because it does. It takes a long time just to make some headway, you know. Like I'm so there's someone in my life currently that's going into therapy, and they're like, "All right, man, I've been three times. When does it start getting better?" I'm like, "I don't know." I'm like, "I'm still working on the same stuff, you know." And it's been years, and they're like, "Oh man, well, why am I doing it?" I'm like, "Well, doesn't it at least allow you to kind of think your way through stuff?" And like my therapist has said to me multiple times, he's like, "Dude, I'm not going to fix your problem. I'm going to give you ways for you to try to deal with it and give you tools that, you know, that some people are born with, some people aren't." I've learned over the years that I don't naturally have a lot of positive emotional reactions to things. I have a tendency to, you know, to get angry or to get inside my brain and get sad and you know, and kind of, you know, mope around. It's like the therapy is like, here's your breathing exercises. Here's ways you can think and try to get some perspective. And I do love that because, man, I totally get where she's coming from. And it's like, just give me more of whatever I can take. And let's fix this, because what we're doing is not satisfying at that moment. But, you know, if she would have just stuck with it.
Yeah, and one of the things that you said earlier, you said when you first started talking about this, that it doesn't necessarily excuse the way she acts in therapy. You know what? It does, in my mind. You can act however you brought that point up, but you can. It's a safe space. I think one of the coolest things I thought about the way they depicted this is that she started to go to a place where she was going to say something about wanting to almost like kill Annie. Like she just can't stand her sometimes. And she stopped herself. And the therapist was like, "No, finish that thought." And like, I really appreciated that. Cause I was like, you know, this is where you can vent that out. And then we're going to talk about it to make sure that you're just venting that out. You're not going to carry through that, you know? And sometimes saying that aloud is actually part of making sure it doesn't happen. You know what I mean?
Very much so, because once you kind of put those thoughts out there, they're out there. It's a good release. And you need, like, one thing that we if you listen to our Baltimore Comic Con coverage episode, you know that when we were engaging and talking with these artists about how do you think that we can better, you know, break this stigma around mental health or to have easily make these conversations easier, it's finding an outlet really works. I think for us, like, I went through a season of depression and my outlet became podcasting. You know, one of the co-hosts of the show before he stepped down was music. And so everyone has those, but you know, I love the way that this film just is so brutally and raw and honest with its portrayal of mental health.
Yeah. I can't think of another horror movie that plays it so straight and kind of gets it. I mean, can you guys think of anything?
Negative.
Except for,
Well,
I was going to try to make a joke. I went blank. The coffee's wearing off.
All right. Well, we are. Here's what I want to do is if you guys are listening to this right now and you guys can think of what are some ways that you guys think therapy can be or an outlet that could be therapeutic as a way to deal with the stresses of everyday life or anxiety or depression. More importantly, if you guys are listening to this right now and you or someone you know is struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression, Please make sure that you guys reach out to us on any of our social media. We have links in the descriptions. Suicide is currently the 10th leading cause of death in the United States. There are 123 suicides that take place each and every day. And for every successful one of those suicides, 125 more being attempted. That's 3,075 suicides. And when you scale back internationally, there are 800,000 successful suicides. That's one death roughly every 40 seconds. We cannot encourage you guys enough that there is so much hope, so much to stay with us. If you can just hold on for one more day, if you guys need someone to talk to, reach out to us. And with that, where can people find this group more on Grindhouse Messiah and Farsighted Network?
Well, really everything can be found at farsightedblog.com. That's really the best place to go. We're also on social media. We're on Twitter at Grindhouse Messiah. We're at Instagram at Grind Messiah. We're at on Facebook as part of the Farsighted Network. We have both a page and a group. So check that stuff out. And one of the things that I really appreciate having Josh, having you kind of come aboard with doing some stuff with us over the last couple of years is we've kind of made it also a point of ours to really get involved in more of this mental health and suicide prevention stuff. And it's something that I strive to get even more involved in. And, you know, if you ever need to reach out to anyone, yeah, we're here.
No, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, hopefully you guys come and check that out. And I mean, yeah, cause as much as we like to goof around and everything like that, we also take that very serious, and it's something that I think touches all of us. So yeah, I was really excited when we all kind of started teaming up because, with Victims and Villains and all your podcasts coming in, I love going on the show because it gives me a chance to talk about something that I don't talk about all the time, but it has become such an important focus of my life. So no, I really appreciate that. So yeah, make sure everybody, you guys check out. And if you're listening to part two first, go back to Grindhouse Messiah, listen to part one, and let us listen to us actually make our way to this conversation.
And you guys can find us everywhere, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and iTunes. Make sure that you guys like, follow, and subscribe to us. And if you guys like what we stand for, make sure that you guys support us on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/victimsandvillains. Consider being a part of our Facebook group, Hope Culture, and sign up for our monthly newsletter. Not to mention, again, you guys can go to victimsandvillains.net/hope for resources if you guys are struggling with suicide, addiction, self-harm, or depression. And until next time, remember to keep talking, nerd, talking hope, and speaking nothing else. And remember, until next time, keep riding the white horse.